So that was a really exciting day for us to open that farmhouse after so many years. And we celebrated together. The farmhouse is going to be open after the service today, and we have some cookies and cider, so you can head over there. Cookies made to a traditional 1850s recipe by Rachel Tonkin. Where's Rachel? Thank you, Rachel, for that. So we'll have a little community time after this, and you can have a look around and see just how amazing it is. We also had our farm planting day yesterday. It's the beginning of the growing season. I think we have some pictures of that here as well. We had a whole load of people turn up. We got an amazing amount of work done. So we're sort of ready for growing. If you missed that, firstly, thank you to everybody who came out. But if you missed it, don't worry, because there's going to be plenty more opportunities for you to come out and weed and harvest and join in with all the fun. So again, thank you everybody for coming yesterday. Okay, we are going to let our younger members, the children, head out now. If you want to head out elementary this way and preschoolers on this side. And while they're heading out, why don't we just turn around, greet one another, welcome one another, people behind you, in front of you, to the side, and then we'll move on. Okay, so my name is Matthew, by the way. I'm the lead pastor here and want to welcome everybody. Thank you so much for coming. If you're on Zoom, thank you for joining us. Welcome to you too. It's great to be a community together. And actually, that's our theme today. Our theme today is all about community, because we're starting a new series, which is called God Is Not Distant. And we're sort of addressing, I suppose, the irony of the fact that here we are, all religious people who kind of show up, maybe not every Sunday, some of us perhaps, but you know, we show up pretty regularly at a religious group like this, a community. But at the same time, very often we don't necessarily feel God. We perhaps even ask, is God near? Is God real? And we live with that tension, right? We live with that sort of paradox in many respects. And so we're just going to explore that a little bit during this series, and we're going to look at different ways that we can experience God in everyday life. Our sort of premise is that maybe God isn't absent, it's just that we are variable in our ways to perceive God, experience God, understand God. And so we're going to sort of practice and grow in the art of experiencing God. And today we're thinking about experiencing God through community, through relationships. And I don't really want to spend too much time talking about the reality of that, because I think, you know, like, you know, why do we experience God through relationships? Because I think we actually sort of intuitively know that's true. We've all experienced the beauty of love, the beauty of friendship, of relationships, and kind of had a divine experience, a transcendent experience through that. I mean, relationships are perhaps some of our most profound relationships. To be loved and accepted, and also to love somebody else. They're just amazing experiences. So I think we all kind of get in a way that that's a divine experience in some respect, if we've been engaging in that way. There's an interesting story in the Hebrew scriptures actually, where two twin brothers, Jacob and Esau, kind of have a major falling out. Jacob actually cheats Esau. It's kind of a sad story, but there's a reconciliation that takes place towards the end, where he approaches his brother again, and he's worried that his brother's going to, Esau won't forgive him and might even kill him. But Esau responds with forgiveness and love and kindness. And Jacob makes a really interesting statement. He says, because you've loved me, because you've received me with favor, to see your face is to see the face of God. And you know, I think, again, we have that sort of intuitive experience where we experience God through loving relationships. In the musical Les Miserables, Victor Hugo, who wrote the novel, didn't actually say this, but in the musical it says, to love another person is to see the face of God, right? It's a similar kind of concept. Jesus said, when you do this to the least of these, you do it to me. So there's that connection of loving people is actually loving God. Loving people is a spiritual experience. Being loved is a spiritual experience. Now, last week we celebrated Easter, right? We celebrated the resurrection. So what I want to start off just after the resurrection. Let's look at a passage from John chapter 20. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you." And with that, he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone's sins, their sins are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven." And I think here we have perhaps a beautiful summary of this whole notion of community. This is Jesus is back from the dead. He's loving and comforting his disciples. They're afraid. And he comes to them. He breathes his spirit into them. And he says, "Peace." And that word peace, it's Jesus is speaking Aramaic, but it's written down in Greek and then translated into English, right? But in the Aramaic language, it would have been much more familiar or much more similar to the Hebrew language, which for which the word for peace is shalom. And we're probably sort of familiar with that word. So Jesus is here is saying shalom to his followers. And that word conjures up so much more than simply don't be anxious, don't be afraid. I mean, it includes that, but the word shalom means wholeness and completeness and restoration. And it's about reconciliation. And it's this idyllic ideal. That the Hebrew people longed for and actually kind of looked to the future for, that one day all people will be reconciled, would all the barriers between us all would be removed. And I think we can relate to this. Here's Jesus saying, not only is he giving his peace to his followers, but he's saying, okay, over to you now. As the Father sent me, so I send you. So our mission, very nature of our spirituality is reconciliation, inclusion. That's what it's about. And we experience that in our personal lives, like when we experience inclusion, when we experience acceptance, when we experience forgiveness from somebody, that's a beautiful experience. But we also know what the opposite of that is, right? We also experience pain and loss and disappointment in relationships, and we experience rejection and loneliness. And likewise, in that sort of more systemic, the more social order of things, we experience the fact that we can do amazing things together as human beings. When we collaborate, we've accomplished incredible things, but we're also blowing each other to pieces. And no matter what we look at, whether it's gender issues, race issues, ethnicity issues, national issues, sexuality, whatever it is, there seem to be reasons for division and reasons for repression. So it's a mixed bag. It's a really mixed bag. And I think what we can conclude then is probably this whole notion of community is not going to be some sort of kumbaya situation where we're all suddenly fall in love with each other and we're all getting on and everything's beautiful. It's going to be somewhat messy. It's going to be somewhat difficult. It's going to be a struggle, but it's a struggle that's worth it. And we see Jesus living that struggle out. So here he is at the end of his time on earth, breathing his spirit into people. But Jesus was this inclusive, collaborative, loving and accepting person all through. And you just have to look at his followers. Like, he had a real mixed bag of followers. There was a tax collector in his immediate entourage called Matthew, who would have been viewed as a traitor, right? A Roman traitor. You also had a zealot who would be Simon the Zealot, who would have, we don't really know whether he was a member of the Zealot party, but he was definitely anti-Rome. So you have two people from very different backgrounds with very different perspectives or had very different perspectives in the same group together. We had brothers for sure. You know, we got James and John, they were brothers. But they were called the sons of thunder. It seems like they argued and fell out a lot. And we see the followers of Jesus falling out a lot, right? We've just been going through a series in Mark's gospel where Jesus is constantly rebuking them. So he's loving and accepting, but he's also having to say, come on, just get on with each other, love one another, accept one another. Don't try to be the best. Don't try to get ahead of other people. Don't compete for who's the greatest, et cetera, et cetera. So again, it's kind of messy. And we don't necessarily either see the whole picture unless we sort of think and extrapolate a little bit, because probably this, when we think about the disciples, the 12, as they're sometimes called, I don't even notice, they're all men. Have you noticed that? But was it that Jesus just thought, you know, I need to pick 12 people and they've got to be men? Or is it that there's a little bit of sort of patriarchal revision of telling the story that is there in the text, which wouldn't be surprising at all. So, you know, that's why they're recorded as all being men. But clearly we see from the text too that Jesus has a lot of women in his entourage, the people that are following with him. He reaches out to Roman citizens. He reaches out to Pharisees. There are Pharisees. The Pharisees get a bad rap, but there are Pharisees that follow Jesus. It's a really mixed bag of people. And somehow Jesus is able to bring this diverse group of people together and get to this point where they're together. They're afraid, but they're together. And he's breathing his spirit into them and saying, now it's over to you. Go out and create this community of hope. Go out and create this community of healing, this community of reconciliation. That was Jesus's mission. Now, when we think about Jesus, though, also there's a vulnerability, I think, when it comes to community, because earlier in John's gospel, Jesus says to his followers in John chapter 15, I no longer call you servants because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I've called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I've made known to you. So Jesus called his followers friends. I don't think Jesus is just pretending. I don't think like Jesus has got this, okay, relationships is my job, it's my mission, so you know, I just got to get it on and do it. He actually likes these people, and he actually needs them. You know, we saw that when we read parts of the Easter story where Jesus kind of at his darkest moment just wanted his friends to be with him. And they kind of let him down. That's what's so tragic about it. But it's like Jesus really needed to be with his friends at the most vulnerable parts of his life. And again, I think we can all relate to that, right? And both the need and perhaps sometimes feeling let down or feeling lonely. And Jesus had special friends as well. There were people, you know, Peter, James, and John were often ones that he seemed to spend more time with, special time with. And that's not like, a competitive thing or a hierarchical thing so much as we all have people close to us that are special to us, that are important to us, who again we experience the beauty of relationship with because it's much more intimate, but also risk and experience the pain of loss when we are disappointed or when we do get hurt. And Jesus experienced all of that too. But Jesus not only Jesus wasn't just loving people that he liked. Jesus kind of redefined even how we think about community. Again, in Mark's gospel, we went through this in two parts. Part one was last year. So this scripture is from that. So it's, you know, a little more in the distant past for us. But you may remember this story. Jesus is, you know, he's speaking in houses. He's speaking in public. And his own family think he's gone crazy. They think he's nuts, and they've come to do an intervention on him. And they're out. He's inside. They're outside, sort of knocking on the door. And then Jesus' mother and brothers arrive, standing outside. They sent someone in to call him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they told him, "Your mother and brothers are outside looking for you." Now, I don't know how you would, if somebody's about to do an intervention on you, I'm not sure I'd respond this way, but Jesus is kind of, not orthodox. "Who are my mother and my brothers?" he asks. Then he looked at those seated in a circle around him and said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother." Now, that could sound very like dismissive of his family. And if I was a family member, I'd probably feel like, really? It's a bit unkind. But I think the point Jesus is making here, or perhaps what Jesus is doing here, is redefining family. It's like we stay in our groups, their familial groups, or our cliques of friendships. But this community is way more inclusive than that. And, this is not that like man and a woman and 2.2 children definition of family. It's a way more inclusive, diverse definition of what family means. And so that's why we call one another brothers and sisters, right? We're part of this family because of what Jesus, the kind of community that Jesus created. And, you know, I think maybe we could put the next slide up, Greg. In some respects, this is a glimpse of the kind of community that we hear about at the right at the end of the Christian scriptures in the book of Revelation, which is this kind of dreamlike vision about the future. Maybe the end of the earth. I mean, it's very metaphorical. It's very pictorial in the way that it articulates the language. But there's this image at the end there. After this, I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. I mean, look at every tribe, nation, people, language. I mean, it's covering all the options here, pretty much, when it comes to nationalities. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands. Sounds a bit like us a couple of weeks ago. And they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." We'll talk about salvation in a minute and its connection to community. But that's the vision, right? That's the vision of Jesus. That's the vision of hope that Jesus brought, the healing of humanity. Now, the followers of Jesus kind of started off practicing this. You know, so after Jesus is gone, they start trying to put this into practice. And it goes pretty well, it seems like. In the book of Acts, we read in Acts chapter 2, all the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to everyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Again, that word salvation, saved. So there's something profound happening. And you think like, whoa, this is kind of like perhaps we're on our way to this image that we later hear about in the book of Revelation. This is progress. And again, later on in Acts chapter 4, similar kind of language. All the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and God's grace was so powerfully at work in them all that there was no needy person among them. From time to time, those who owned land or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales, and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to everyone who had need. And this is the main point of my message. I want you to sell your houses and bring all the money, lay it at my feet, and I will make sure it goes to the right place. Okay? Just so you can trust me. No, if I said that, I think there's something inappropriate about asking that, right? People seem to just do it because they loved one another so much. They wanted to share what they had. Something really profound is happening here. However, by chapter 6, and we're not necessarily in chronicle orders of chapters, it's not like 2 and then 4 and then 6 and this 3 equally spaced out, but by chapter 6, here's what's going on. In those days when the number of disciples was increasing, it's getting a little more complicated now, the Hellenistic Jews among them complained against the Hebraic Jews because their widows were being overlooked in the daily distribution of food. Okay, so basically, they're looking after one another, but there's some inequity that's crept in. There's some favoritism. It's not as inclusive as it's meant to be. So, and we read a lot in the book of Acts about arguments and divisions and struggle and difficulty and dispersal of people because of that, not just because of persecution from the outside, but because of divisions from the inside. Anyway, so the 12, you remember those male-only disciples of Jesus, gathered all the disciples together and said, it would not be right for us to neglect the ministry of the word of God in order to wait on tables. So they're going to stay, you know, reading the Bible and praying. Brothers and sisters, choose 7 men from among you who are known to be full of the spirit and wisdom. Men again, you see that there. So, you know, I think there's a little bit of patriarchy here, but we will turn this a little bit. You know, we'll turn this responsibility over to them and we'll give our attention to prayer and the ministry of the word. This proposal pleased the whole group, and they chose Stephen, a man full of faith. Anyway, they chose a bunch of people. We can just skip the rest of it. It's 7 people that they chose, right? So what happens is it's not kumbaya, it's reality. And this is what we're living with, and we should live with the reality of that it doesn't always work out. But what do? They talk about it. Somebody says, you know, there's an issue, and they listen, and they work through it. So we have this sort of example of messiness, but we've got to work through the messiness. So what I wanted to do just now for the next half is just look at a story, that's a story about Jesus that I think can help us look at some of the challenges, some of the messiness of community, and how, as we address them, if we were able to, we could perhaps experience deeper community, and as a result of that, experience more of God, right? Because this is about experiencing God through community. Now, you know, I think we've got to be careful about separating those out so that, like, somehow community becomes a means to an end. Because I think what Jesus is saying is like, look, as we experience love among one another, we experience God. It's like you can't separate them out. So it's all about experiencing community. So we're going to look at the story of Zacchaeus in, or as you say, Zacchaeus, right? So, but it's actually Zacchaeus in the original language, just so you know. story of Zacchaeus, I'm going to read it. It's just a very short story, 10 verses. And then what I'm going to do, just going to ask four questions about the text, and then we'll ask four questions of ourselves, and then we'll be done. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. So he's not going to stop, apparently. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead, climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter. It's a great word, mutter. "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." Okay, so let's just unpack this story a little bit. It's a great story. Anybody heard that story before? Yeah, it's a pretty well-known story, right? Even outside of church settings, I think. Beautiful story. It's sort of full of, I think, ambiguity, if we look at it. Irony, perhaps, as well. It's sort of comedic. There's this guy who climbed a tree to see Jesus. You know, it's just a really interesting story. A little bit of background here. Jesus, in Luke, is on this journey from Galilee, the area where he grew up and lived and began his ministry, very poor area. He's been moving around in Galilee, and now, after chapter 9 in Luke, where it says Jesus set his face towards Jerusalem, he's on his way to Jerusalem. And he's sort of picking up all these people along the way, different stories about women and children and people with diseases that would normally make them be excluded. There's Samaritans, you know, he tells stories about Samaritans, and Jesus is sort of on this journey, and the way Luke writes the story, it's kind of like he's just gathering people as he goes, and he's on his way to Jerusalem. Now, he comes to Jericho, which is kind of like the last big stop before Jerusalem. And Jericho is a very significant city. It's a very wealthy city. It's significant for two reasons, I guess. The wealth, it was the center of the balsam trade back then. So, you know, a lot of income coming into the city. And a rich city. And it's also the city where all the priests would live. So it's not far from Jerusalem. And that story that Jesus told about, the guy who gets mugged on the way on his journey between Jerusalem and Jericho, and priests are coming back and forth, that story is kind of realistic, because people would make that journey, or the priests would make that journey. The people in the sort of hierarchy of religion often lived in Jericho. Now, it's interesting that Jesus is passing through, right? So Jesus isn't going to hobnob with the priests, and it doesn't sound like he's even going to stop. He's just on his way through Jericho, but he's sort of apprehended, or he's distracted, or his attention's caught by this guy in a tree, right? And so it's sort of, again, it's just a bit of a bizarre thing. And so we're going to ask four questions about this text. So the first one is, what does salvation mean? Maybe we can, not yet, Greg, on that one. So, you know, it says here, today salvation has come to this house because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost, right? So, in other words, Jesus is talking about salvation and actually saying His purpose is to bring salvation. Well, that word salvation, as we've often said here, is the word sozo in the Greek language, and it gets translated save, as in rescue, but it can also mean save as in heal, as in make whole, as in restore. And generally, when Jesus is using it in these kinds of contexts, that seems to be what he's talking about, because here's a story about somebody who got included, somebody who was excluded for all kinds of reasons, which we'll get into in a moment. But now he's included. And Jesus says that's salvation. That's what salvation is. In other words, the whole point of this, the whole point, if you like, of our spirituality, the whole point of our experience of God is reconciliation and inclusion. It's belonging, both our experience of belonging as well as including other people. That's what Jesus seemed to be saying salvation is, as opposed to believing the right things and maybe one day going to heaven. It's about a new reality in the very real world that we, with all its messiness, that we live in now. Now, another question we could ask here is, who's doing the excluding? Anybody want to answer that question? Who's being exclusive here? Well, it says actually in the text, all the people saw this and muttered, he's eating with sinners. So the inference here is that all the people are doing the exclusion. So this isn't just one or two hierarchical snobs doing the excluding. Okay, we've got some stereotypes here, haven't we? So we've got the tax collector. Zacchaeus is a tax collector. We know all about tax collectors, except we don't really, because in the stereotype in which the story is told, he's the bad guy. But we always know tax collector. If a tax collector's in a story, something's good is going to happen, right? That's because we've got all this context now. If a prostitute is in a story, something's good is going to happen, right? And that didn't sound right. Sorry, that didn't sound so. But you know what I mean. With a tax collector, the tax collector would have been viewed a certain way in that context, and that's how the people in the story are viewing him. He's a cheat. What the situation in, as we know, the Romans used local people to collect the taxes, and rather than paying them completely, they would have to sort of skim off the top. The tax collectors would charge a little more tax than they were supposed to, keep the difference and pass the rest on to the Romans. So they were despised both because they were collaborating with the Romans, the occupying forces, the occupying nation, the imperialists, and because they were cheating. So it's kind of it has a social and a systemic exclusion aspect to it, but also a very personal one. They know him and he's a cheat. Now, ironically, the word or the name Zacchaeus means innocent. We'll get to that in a second, but there's a bit of a clue here that maybe he's not as bad as it may seem. But all the people are excluding him. And you get the impression that it's not just at the point when Jesus goes and eats with him that they mutter. You can imagine in the crowd when they're looking for Jesus that Zacchaeus comes along, and Zacchaeus is short. And you know, it would be more socially appropriate to allow a shorter person to move to the front of the crowd. I can imagine them sort of like keeping him out. It's that tax collector, cheat. And they're stopping him. They're probably preventing him. And so he has to climb a tree. He has to climb a tree to see. So there's a bit of a twist in this story. It's not the Pharisees. It's not the priests. It's not the rich or the hierarchies that are doing the exclusion. It's all the people like you and me. And I think, again, we can relate to it, right? There are people that we don't really like for all sorts of different reasons. Might be because of physical or social issues that we don't like them. There's some physical issues to do with Zacchaeus, which maybe, it's like, it's what they say, what they do. There's all sorts of reasons why we might despise somebody. And that's a reality. That's part of the mess we're talking about. Now, another question we've got to ask is, why does Zacchaeus want to see Jesus? So he climbs this tree. He's desperate to see Jesus, clearly. Because if I was Zacchaeus and I knew I was that unpopular, and I might be, I just don't know it, just so you know. But he knows it, right? You don't want to go out in crowds when you're really unpopular, when you've been branded this way. You don't want to go out in a crowd. So what drives him? What makes him so driven to see Jesus? And I think there's, this is reading into the text a little bit, perhaps, but it's a story. And I think we're invited into these stories to kind of experience them and try to work out what's going on. But you get this sense that he wants to change, right? He must have heard about Jesus. He's a friend of tax collectors. He's a friend of sinners. Maybe there's some hope for me. And maybe Zacchaeus wants to change. But in a way, he's not being allowed to change because he's being excluded. Do you know what I mean? He might want to, look, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to be this person. But there's a narrative about him now. True or otherwise, there's a narrative about him, which is you're a cheat, you're a tax collector, you're a traitor, etc. And again, we have narratives about people, don't we? It's like they're a weirdo, they're awkward, they're mean, they're such a dot, 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 dot. And we just brand somebody and we create that narrative. And it's really hard both for that person to get out of that narrative, to be something else. And certainly it becomes very hard for us then to see them as something else because that we just go into that groove very, very easily. Oh, that's that so-and-so. But maybe Zacchaeus has hope because maybe Jesus can do something about this. Because I don't want to be alienated. I don't want to be on the outside. I want to be part of this community. Perhaps that's why he goes to see Jesus. And I think the key word of this whole passage for me personally, is the word if. Because Zacchaeus says, if you remember, I'm going to give everything I have to the poor. Sorry, I'm going to give half of what I have to the poor. And I'm going to give anybody I cheated. So he says, if I cheated anyone, I'll give them four times what I cheated them out of. So there's a big if. He doesn't say, I'll give four times what I cheated at all the people. He's saying, if I cheated anybody. Now, that could be the sort of the cop out. It's like, well, if I offended you, then I'm really sorry. I mean, it could be, you know, the non-apology. Or it could be maybe he didn't cheat everybody. I mean, even if we just do the math on this, think about it. Say he made 20 grand by cheating everybody. Well, he's just given 10 grand of it away because he's given half. And if he made all that other 10 grand from cheating everybody, he's got to give 40 grand back. He doesn't have enough money, right? So now he might have just cheated a few and played the stock market or something like that and made even more money. And so he would be able to do it. I don't know. But I think there's a big question mark. And perhaps the author of Luke is painting that question mark really big by giving the name or assigning the name Zacchaeus, innocent, to this person. It's at least begging the question. It's either irony, he's not at all innocent, or it's maybe he's more innocent than you think. And it's nearly always a mixture, isn't it? Like when we get to know people who we don't particularly like, often we grow to like them more. We understand more. We understand where somebody's coming from. We understand why they're prickly or why they're socially difficult or why they can be mean or what they've been going through in their lives. And I think we've all experienced that. So the fourth question would be, what does Zacchaeus do? What does Zacchaeus do? Well, I've just sort of said it. He makes a massive change. Right? So Jesus just says to him, I'm coming to your house. And Zacchaeus says, I'll give half to the poor, half of what I have to the poor. I'll pay back four times, which was the highest requirement of the Hebrew law when you've cheated somebody. There were these laws about if you defraud somebody, you have to pay back more than you defrauded them from, kind of a preventative measure. The maximum penalty or the maximum you could do is four times. He's just voluntarily saying, I'll give four times away if I've cheated anybody. He's making radical action. So it's Zacchaeus isn't just going, look, so I'm a cheat. Love me anyway or accept me anyway. Right. And he's saying, OK, I'm going to actually do something in a sort of reciprocal thing to this love I've experienced from Jesus, which is, in a way, making myself more lovable. Right. I mean, it's not people pleasing, but it's I have a responsibility to the community. I need to make restitution here. And again, I think we can relate to that perhaps, because it's not okay just to be mean, right? If you think about relationships, we can't really expect everybody just to love us and be nice to us and want to be around us if we're not actually contributing something and working at our own lives and making transformation in our own lives, just like Zacchaeus is doing. So there's this sort of two-way thing. It's about acceptance. We have no excuse not to accept, but also we don't have any excuse not to change either, and not to have the integrity to work at our relationships. And it's a clumsy phrase, but in a way, make ourselves more lovable. That's one of the healthiest things we can do for other people and for ourselves, is to work at our own lives and become more whole. Now, we can put that other slide up now, Greg. So we're just going to spend a little bit of time reflecting on these questions. Andy, the band can come back up now. So some questions that we'll just take a, you know, just run through them, and we'll take a moment to reflect on them very personally. How do I need to reach out? So we're thinking about experiencing God through community. Are there some ways we need to reach out and ways that we're not? And so, you know, kind of the question, who is my family, if you like? Can we broaden that? Are there people intentionally or unintentionally, knowingly or unknowingly, that we're just excluding because they're not our kind of people? They're difficult, they're prickly, they're whatever, or they're just sort of not on my radar. How can we be more inclusive? Dorothy Day, who was a leader in the Catholic Worker Movement, said, "You love God as much as the one you love the least." Now, that could be a very condemning statement, or it could be a very liberating statement, actually. And it sounds like Jesus, doesn't it? It sounds like Jesus. Let's go back to that list, Greg. Who are my friends? Now, we need friends, right? There are people who, it's like, we don't have to try to love them. We just love them. They're maybe close family, or they're just close friendships. And we need those. And we need to invest in those relationships. And it may be that we've neglected some of those closer relationships. We take them for granted, but we need them, and they need us. Where is my center? We'll get more into this next week when we look at contemplative practice, but we can't be defined by relationships, right? I mean, as we deal with issues in our own lives, as we are more centered and grounded as human beings and more able to work at our own stuff, we become more healthy and more encouraging, more supportive, less critical, less bitter, less resentful, etc., more forgiving. And so it actually fuels our relationships in a positive kind of way. And then finally, what is my climate? I've used this term climate here, I couldn't think of a better expression, but it's kind of, what's our aura, if you like? What's our vibe? Like, we might want to experience deeper relationship and more inclusion. Are there things we can do to be easier to include, right? The onus is not only on everybody to include us, but on us to work at our issues, to work at our stuff, and to be honest about that and real about it, and humble enough to say it might not all be everybody else's fault. But as we come round full circle on this story, so we want to end on this as we reflect. It's really interesting, I think, the timing of this story, because Jesus doesn't wait for Zacchaeus to say, "I'll give half of my possessions to the poor and four times to anybody if I've cheated anybody." He just says, "Hey, I'm coming to your house." He just accepts him. So the prerogative is always acceptance. Imagine if we just loved and accepted people and did that not abstractly, but practically, with everybody, even people that we don't particularly like, people we don't necessarily get on with. I'm not sure, you know, with Jesus, Jesus grew up in Galilee, right, which was a hotbed of resistance to Roman oppression. I don't think Jesus probably would say, I really like tax collectors. We don't know. But Jesus loved tax collectors. And that's what we're called to. That's how we experience God. That's how we experience this mystery of seeing the face of God in the other. So let's just take a moment before the band lead us in our final song. Let's just take a moment to reflect on that list and think about, okay, where is God challenging me? How might I experience more of God in any one of those issues?